was well argued on both sides. All right, our next case for the day is Wallace versus TSI Inc. And we'll hear first from counsel for Mr. Wallace.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Stephen Mulheron, and I represent Tyler Wallace. Mr. Wallace is entitled to a new trial. The critical question is where. On jurisdiction, the district court engaged in a one-sided merits determination to find that Stacey Campbell was fraudulently joined. This was error, and because it was never cured, the proper remedy is to vacate the judgments and remand the action back to state court. The district court also permitted the entirety of a written legal opinion from an ALJ into evidence. This allowed TSI to use the ALJ as its shadow expert and represent to the jury that his ultimate conclusions were dispositive of the claims before them, even though they were not and, in fact, could not be. I'll begin with jurisdiction. Mr. Wallace brought a C-1 claim under Alabama's workers' comp statute for co-employee liability. Now, Mr. Wallace did not have to prove that Mr. Campbell had the specific intent to harm him, only that a reasonable person in Mr. Campbell's position would have been substantially certain that the injury would occur. Now, TSI bore the heavy burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Wallace had no possibility of establishing a C-1 claim against Mr. Campbell.
But the way that you pled this, I'm not sure that you're able to meet that.
On the pleading standard, so Mr. Wallace, the Alabama pleading standard of notice pleading applies. It's not a heightened federal standard for plausibility. It's just notice. And Mr. Wallace did submit additional evidence beyond the allegations in the complaint. That evidence consisted of an affidavit and also consisted of deposition testimony as well as LP's own policy
right.
documents.
I read through all of that, and I mean, the notice pleading, yes, but what I think what you pled was that there are sort of two theories that you're going under in your, right? And I don't see the second theory in your pleading.
The second theory being the C-1?
The second theory being that that he understaffed, he knew that it was understaffed and he didn't, and that it was dangerous and that people were doing other people's jobs, that part of it.
Okay. That's part of it. And then the additional evidence was that LP's own policy documents established that Stacey Campbell, the plant manager, had the responsibility for approving alternative guardian measures at the plant. That alternative guardian measures include things like erecting barriers to prevent access to conveyors with dangerous nip points.
Right. But then the problem there is that we have the evidence of his having been there since 2014 or something of that nature, and never having had an incident at all and no reports or complaints. And there's nothing contradicting that in the record.
Our position that there is evidence contradicting that in the record, because intent's slippery, right? You can't prove intent through direct evidence typically. You have to put forward circumstantial evidence. And so what Mr. Wallace did was put forward circumstantial evidence in the form of LP's own policy documents showing that Stacey Campbell did, in fact, have a responsibility to approve alternative guardian measures. He also testified that Stacey
But he'd still have to, I mean, under the standard the standard under Alabama law, he'd have to have known about it and willfully decided not to do anything about it, right?
I believe the standard is slightly different. It's what a reasonable person in his position would, if a reasonable person would have been substantially certain that the injury would occur. So his,
right. It would have been substantial certainty. But how would he have been substantially certain? What did you show to make it clear that he would have been substantially certain, or at least to call that into question?
What we showed is that a reasonable person in Stacey Campbell's position, a reasonable person who is responsible for approving measures to guard, a reasonable person who saw employees cleaning around an unguarded nip point, there's a possibility that they would have known there was substantial certainty that injury would occur. And also a reasonable person who did in fact guard other nip points at the facility. So that taken together would bear on Mr. Campbell's knowledge, and certainly a reasonable person having all that knowledge, there's a possibility that they might have been substantially certain that the injury would occur. And one thing that I would point out is that in the district court's order denying remand, virtually all of the cases that the district court relies on are Alabama cases decided on summary judgment after the parties had a full and fair opportunity to develop the record. Mr. Wallace doesn't have to win on summary judgment in a remand posture. He just has to show that there was a possibility. And I think that's important. I've been unable to locate an Alabama case that tracks our facts. And because there's no Alabama case directly on point here, that favors remand. There's uncertainty. And when there's any uncertainty, remand is the correct course of action to take.
All right. I want to give you a chance to get to the merits in case we reach them. So if you want to address that.
Yes, I'll start with the ALJ decision.
And just to be clear, so prior to trial, or you raised an objection to the inclusion of the decision which the district court denied. You renewed that objection on the record. The court continued to deny it. And I guess I just want to be clear in terms of the basis for the denial, because I know relevance is an issue, prejudicial nature. So I guess my first question is, do you agree that the factual findings from the decision, the ALJ decision, were proper, or none of the decision was proper?
Our position is that the ALJ decision should not have come into evidence at all. And that's because of its inherently prejudicial nature.
So even the factual findings you would consider to be excluded? Because my general understanding is that legal conclusions are shaky, but factual findings too should be excluded?
No, this court's made clear, the Supreme Court's made clear, factual findings in otherwise admissible public records do come in under the 8038 exception. That's true. This specific piece of evidence is so prejudicial, and it's difficult to unwind the factual findings versus the legal conclusions. And for that reason alone, district courts have the ability to exclude it under 401 and 403, which is what should have happened here. Now, certainly, if a remedy on remand, if this court chooses to do so, if there's an instruction for the district court to disentangle those two things, we would be fine for that. But our position is that the entirety of it shouldn't have come in, just given how prejudicial it was.
Prejudicial, I just don't know that that's the right objection. I mean, it's not prejudicial in that it makes the jury just more likely to believe the other side. It seems like a hearsay objection or an improper opinion testimony objection would have been likely better. But I'm just not sure that I see this as precedential so much as improper for other reasons.
Judge Grant, we view it as extremely prejudicial, and I would point the court to how TSI used it during the trial. From opening until close, they represented to the jury that the ALJ had considered its design decision to guard this by location. We know that is not true. The ALJ's inquiry was limited to what the employer LP's duties were under OSHA.
But that's still not prejudice. I mean, prejudice is, examples of other very bad things that someone did, or, you know, I just don't see how making an argument that you could object to is the same thing as prejudice.
Prejudice is undue influence. And representing to a jury that a judge in a separate agency action against a non-party already made a finding, already decided the issues that the jury had to consider themselves in the first instance, that's going to create undue influence. And our position is, if you read this record, there's no way to say with fair assurance that it didn't improperly sway the jury.
What do we do with the fact that in opening statement, it was presented by your client? I mean, it was raised by your client in the first instance, the ALJ decision. And in addition, there was discussion of the investigator's findings, which the ALJ decision goes to, right? So what do we do with that?
So I'll first point out that counsel's statements in opening didn't reference the ALJ by name, didn't get into the substance of...
Did discuss the ALJ report and said, even though the ALJ report, you know, vacated it or whatever, found otherwise, the OSHA investigator determined that this was not guarded by location, right? Didn't you guys say something like that?
Yes, Your Honor. There was a mention that the OSHA investigator found that the machine was not compliant with the guarding regulation, and then counsel said that citation was later vacated. And I think the proper way to look at this is proportionality. So that lone stray comment in opening...
Well, why doesn't that waive any objection you have?
I don't believe, because first, we never introduced the ALJ decision into evidence. That was TSI. They introduced it into evidence. We did not. We objected pretrial.
So they introduced it on Mr. Beard, your expert's testimony, on cross-examination after he had referred extensively to it?
They did introduce it on the cross for our expert.
And it was after he had referred extensively to it. Is that right?
He was asked questions about it. He was, but I would go
indirect.
Back.
Indirect examination.
Yes. I would.
Isn't that a problem for you?
It's a problem, but I want to, let's go back to the beginning.
Okay.
So we moved to exclude it. That motion was denied. On the record, no written opinion. We don't know the reasons why the judge denied it. Denied it from the bench summarily. Before opening, we objected again. So that piece of evidence is coming in. TSI during opening. They show it to the jury. They put it up on a PowerPoint. They
wasn't your opening first?
It was, but that again goes to the proportionality of it.
I mean, I don't see how we could tie your hands. If you've objected to evidence, it would be completely different in my view if you hadn't sought to exclude that evidence in the first place. But you sought to exclude the evidence. You objected to it being in. The judge said, no, it's coming in. So I don't see why we would tie our hands to be able to address that evidence in the opening, since you already are aware that it's coming in. You know, pull the sting, right?
So, well...
You just want to say yes, that's right.
Yeah, I think...
Yes. That's right. That's right.
And I think, and that's why I started with asking you just to clarify that you did object. And to Judge Grant's point, I tend to agree. I mean, at that point, you had to reconcile the fact that it was coming in and try to minimize the damage, if you want to describe it that way. But to Judge Rosenbaum's point, then you use it in a way that you try to make it to your advantage and arguably take it to the next level in terms of its application. And for me, that's where it becomes a bit more problematic, how counsel decided to then use the evidence.
Yep. So, again, it's proportionality. And once that evidence is coming in, we're fighting an uphill battle because the other side is representing to the jury that an unbiased judge, you know, an OSHA-appointed judge, has already determined the issues before you. And that, so yes, we have to do something with that.
But Mr. Beard's entire opinion, I mean, wasn't his expert report, everything was based in part on the ALJ opinion?
No. And this is an important point, Judge Rosenbaum. So he also relied on two other standards. He relied on ANSI standards and the AMSI standards. So OSHA was just a data point in his opinions. It wasn't his sole opinion.
But he reviewed it, and it was in his report, right?
Yes, it was in his report. But again, that's why we have the rules of evidence. You know, what transpires during discovery is subject to gatekeeping by the rules of evidence. We tried to invoke that, but the district court denied the motion, overruled our objections. So things that come up during discovery, during expert discovery, sometimes they don't come into evidence during trial because they're too prejudicial, because they're not relevant.
Let me ask you one other thing.
Sure.
Related to this, which I was starting to get at before, and that is, you did talk about the OSHA investigator. Is it your contention that evidence of what the OSHA investigator determined should have been admissible, but the ALJ report should not have been?
Judge Rosenbaum, again, I would go back to it's our reference to the OSHA investigator did not then open the door and was not proportional to the entirety of the ALJ decision coming in.
Okay, but just to be clear about what you're saying, are you saying you should have been allowed to admit evidence of the OSHA investigator's findings, even though they shouldn't have been allowed to admit evidence of the ALJ opinion finding those to be wrong?
I think the one reason that we reference the OSHA investigators because we know pretrial that the ALJ decision is coming in.
Okay, so I'm just, I guess, I don't know if you can do this as a yes or no, but if you can, that would be helpful to me.
Okay.
Is it your position that you should have been able to reference the OSHA investigators' findings and they shouldn't have been able to admit the ALJ opinion?
Yes.
Okay.
It is, and
thank
it goes
you.
Back to proportionality.
All right, thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, and we took you over, but you've reserved 4 minutes. And because we took you over, Mr. McCarthy, we're going to give you an extra 4 minutes, but you're under no obligation to use that time.
Yes, I'll try not to, Your Honor. All right. May it please the court, Terry McCarthy for TSI. First, the district court was correct in finding fraudulent joinder. The Alabama Workers' Compensation Act sets an extremely high bar for a co-employee claim. A co-employee is immune unless the plaintiff can show willful conduct. And I agree that C2 is what they pled, and that requires the intentional removal of a safety guard or device. It is undisputed that that did not happen here. So there was no possibility of a claim under C2. And as for C1, even if they did plead it, that is an extremely high bar. That requires a conscious design, plan, or intent to injure Mr. Wallace or be substantially certain that injury would occur. And Alabama courts reject C1 claims like this one, where there was absolutely no evidence of other injuries, accidents, or even complaints involving this conveyor.
What about the fact that those rejections were on summary judgment, as far as I can see?
And most of the time, such claims will be at summary judgment, but the Alabama Supreme Court has made clear in case after case, and several of these were cited by the district court, that without evidence of other similar incidents, it's going to be tough to meet a C1 claim.
Right, but at summary judgment rather than at the notice pleading stage, right?
Well, sure, but here the important point here is it was undisputed that there was no evidence whatsoever of other accidents. And Mr. Wallace's affidavit that the court considered in on page 9 of the order denying remand, the district court properly pointed out that all Mr. Wallace said was that, in his opinion, it was a safety concern, that it wasn't adequately staffed, and that is far from meeting willfulness as defined under the Alabama Workers' Compensation Act. So there is no evidence at all, no possibility of a claim based on the pleadings and the evidence before the court that they could state a co-employee claim against Mr. Campbell. If the court were to disagree with that, we believe the district court got the fraudulent joinder analysis correct. If the court were to disagree, there are grounds to correct that. First of all, the court could apply Caterpillar v. Lewis, which gives the court the opportunity to preserve a judgment in a case like this, where considerations of finality and efficiency become overwhelming. And then in addition, if the court believes there is a jurisdictional defect, and we don't believe there is, we would ask the court to exercise its Rule 21 authority and dismiss Mr. Campbell right now, or at the very least, if there's any dispute as to fact, you could remand it to the district court to do a Rule 21 analysis. I'm going to turn to the merits now, unless the court has any questions. As for the merits, they are appealing solely on evidence rulings that are reviewed for abuse of discretion and harmless error. As for the ALJ decision, in their briefing, they make hearsay arguments, but hearsay was not preserved below. And even if hearsay had been preserved, the ALJ decision would satisfy the public records exception to the hearsay rule. In addition, an extensive amount of their briefing is devoted to legal conclusions. And again, that wasn't raised below. It wasn't mentioned in their motion in limine. It wasn't mentioned at trial. The only objections that they made below were relevance and unfair prejudice. And in our system, we have a liberal rule of relevancy. And several actions that they took, both before trial and during trial, placed this evidence at issue.
Well, that was after their motion in limine or other motions to exclude were denied. My concern overall was, I think it was in the closing statement where then the jury is essentially encouraged, arguably, to adopt what the ALJ found. I mean, I think the language is, wouldn't you want to know what a judge who had already reviewed these issues found? How is that not prejudicial?
Well, Your Honor, the point is it is not unfairly prejudicial. At that point, a couple of things. It was in evidence, and so there was an argument based on what had been admitted into evidence. And then in addition, the ALJ decision, almost nearly all of what we relied on at trial was on pages 7 to 12 of the opinion, where the court that the ALJ was determining whether or not it was reasonably predictable for an employee to enter into the zone of danger. Their expert, Mr. Beard, both during pretrial and his deposition and during trial, said that was an appropriate inquiry for what he did, determining whether it was guarded by location. And so that is something that, just arguing based on what the evidence was, we believe is proper.
No, but how you encourage the jury to then apply or interpret or rely upon, if that's the outer limits of that decision. It's one thing to say the factual findings are what they are, you know, the legal conclusions you're not bound by, but that's not what that statement that causes me concern implies.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's something just a lawyer's in closing argument or making an argument based on the evidence.
But it is problematic. I mean, maybe not for the reasons that the plaintiff objected to, but it seems like it's basically asking the jury to accept an expert opinion on the ultimate issue of fact, and that's something that's not allowed. The problem, of course, is that wasn't how it was objected to.
Right. Correct, Your Honor. And so we believe that it was a proper argument. And let me say this also, because I don't know if this came up in opposing counsel's argument, but in the briefing, an argument that they've made on on saying that it's prejudicial and unfairly prejudicial is they've focused on, you know, the word judge in the person's title and that it was a quasi-judicial proceeding. And then the fact that there was judge in the title, that is something the district court can certainly take into consideration in weighing the probative value against the unfair prejudice, but it's not something that's dispositive. And in fact, public records, Rule 803.38, whenever they come in, most of the time it's going to be from an agency or a public official who has some clout and gravitas.
But not that has an
opinion. Which is why the case law suggests that this kind of evidence might be proper before a judge who can make those distinctions as opposed to a jury that lacks that expertise.
Well, but this type of evidence in all kinds of public records routinely are admissible and allowed for the jury to hear. And I want to allude on something that Your Honor raised earlier. I think it's important to focus on before the ALJ decision was ever entered into evidence. Mr. Beard, when he was on direct examination, and this was pointed out earlier, he said that the ALJ did not change or affect his opinion in any way. It had no effect on whether he believed that this conveyor...
But obviously you thought that it would change or affect the jury's opinion in a big way, or else you all wouldn't have made the argument that you did in closing. I mean, were you introducing this ALJ order so the jury could consider the opinion testimony that Louisiana Pacific didn't violate OSHA standards? Or because the risk of harm was not reasonably predictable, or so the jury could consider the factual summary in the background section of the ALJ order? Which one?
Well, or both? Our position is the jury could consider the evidence for whatever reason they wanted to consider it and give it whatever
way. How is an ALJ final decision opinion, how is that appropriate for a jury to consider as opposed to factual questions? Isn't that the same as the ultimate question of law that you were trying to, or the ultimate question that you were trying to convince the jury of?
Well, the jury was instructed on the elements of making a design defect claim under the AEMLD and under negligence, and they were properly instructed on those. And then when the opinion was admitted, they never asked the court to limit it in any way.
I'm not saying they made the right objections, but perhaps they could have. Were you really trying to get this in just for the facts, or were you trying to get it in to say, look, you should make the same ultimate decision that the ALJ did?
Well, the ALJ decision certainly was persuasive, and what they ultimately determined is that it didn't violate the OSHA machine guarding regulation. Mr. Beard opined that it did violate the OSHA machine guarding regulation, and then the jury could use the evidence, you know, weigh all the evidence, the ALJ, Mr. Beard's testimony, and all the evidence, and use it for whatever they deem was proper pursuant to the district court's instructions. And so
even though they didn't object or object properly, which is recognized in the record, we can still review it under some plain error or unduly prejudicial standard in terms of excluding it.
Well, it could be reviewed for plain error, but I don't believe they raised that in their opening brief. But if they did, the court could review it for plain error. But plain error, as the 11th Circuit has said multiple times, is rarely applied in civil cases, and this is not a situation where a plain error analysis would be in play. And so a couple of other things, want to get back to a point that I was making earlier. There's argument about the ALJ being admitted in its entirety first of all, admitting documents in their entirety, that's the norm unless the opposing party asks it to be redacted in some way. And they, you know, one of the things they are arguing here, which they didn't argue below, is that it had words such as prima facie case in it. If they had raised that with us, we could have said, yes, we'll redact it, or the district court could have been given an opportunity to say, yes, let's redact that out. But that was something that they didn't do. But I think it's even more important for this analysis that before Mr. Beard on direct examination, when he basically said this opinion doesn't matter, this ALJ decision doesn't matter, my opinion stands, at that point, it would have been, you know, unfair to not let the jury know what's in the decision so they could decide for themselves what weight, if any, to give it. I only have, you know, a few minutes left. I want to make sure a couple of other points to address. Their unfair prejudice argument, I think we've hit on most of their arguments, but that is something that is an extraordinary remedy used sparingly in Rule 403 decisions are rarely reversed on appeal, and this is certainly not one of those situations. But even if the court were to believe that the district court erred in some way, any error, we'd say, is harmless because plenty of evidence supports the jury's verdict, even separate and apart from the challenged evidence. First of all, contributory negligence. And Alabama law, or Alabama is one of the few states that still follows contributory negligence, where it is a complete bar to recovery. Even a little bit of negligence is enough to be a complete bar. And so the evidence is undisputed, unfortunately, that Mr. Wallace, he violated his training, and then he failed to use safety tools that were available to him that would have kept him at a safe distance to the conveyor. And instead, he was cleaning, squatted down, and duck walking near the machine in an unstable position where he
was. But on a motion to dismiss, I mean, do we need to get into contributory negligence?
On a motion to dismiss is...
Right.
I'm sorry, this was a jury trial.
I'm sorry. Yes, sorry.
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah, this was a jury trial. So the jury could have easily found that just he was negligent and it contributed to his unfortunate injury.
I'm just looking back through the brief because I didn't remember seeing these arguments. Did you make these arguments in your brief?
Yes, it's in the harmless error section. Of our brief. And so, Your Honor, we just believe that there is plenty of evidence to support the verdict. And then, in addition, you know, one of the most important facts in the case, I think, is this was a product liability case, and the issue is whether or not the conveyor was defective. And then, as we said in our brief, TSI had been in business for approximately 32 years. Many states across the country, and they have received no other reported injuries or accidents involving a similar TSI trim waste conveyor. And so that cuts against this machine being an unreasonably dangerous product.
Can I ask a quick question about the contributory negligence piece? Because on page 10 of the ALJ decision, it says the court concludes that notwithstanding the occurrence of the accident, entry to the area surrounding the ingoing nip point was not reasonably predictable. How does that conclusion not weigh in on the contributory negligence piece too? Again, you're trying to say that it had the decision, even if you exclude it, didn't have any impact on the jury, but the decision itself points to the contributory negligence argument as well.
Well, everything that I pointed out a minute ago, all of that was through testimony. So there's a substantial amount of independent evidence.
So you're saying even excluding what the ALJ found, we can still look to the record to see that there's support for that position.
Correct. Okay, and unless the court has any questions, my time is about up, and we ask the court to affirm the district court's judgment.
All right, thank you, Mr. McCarthy. Mr. Mulheron, you have reserved 4 minutes.
Thank you. I want to start with the remand issue. I know we discussed it. I just want to reiterate that this court's decision in Legg held that it was an abuse of discretion for a district court not to consider evidence submitted by the parties on a fraudulent joinder issue. Here, the district court, at the district court's request, we submitted additional evidence, including deposition testimony and LP's own policy documents, but the district court struck it, didn't consider it. That's error in and of itself, because it made a fraudulent joinder determination without considering all the evidence submitted by both of the parties.
What evidence in those records would you point to specifically to show that there is a possibility that your client could satisfy the substantial certainty standard?
In the deposition testimony, we'll point to Mr. Wallace's testimony that Mr. Campbell had in fact seen him cleaning around the unguarded conveyor previously, before this accident. So he knew he had an employee there cleaning around an unguarded nip point. We'll point to the fact that Mr. Wallace testified that another conveyor at LP's facility with a nip point on it was in fact guarded. And then we'll point to the evidence of LP's policy documents that Mr. Campbell was responsible for approving these alternative guarding measures. That taken together bears on what a reasonable person in his position would have known about the likelihood or certainty of an injury occurring. It at least creates a possibility, which is all you have to do on a fraudulent joinder posture. But the district court here refused to consider evidence, relied on cases that were decided at summary judgment. There's no clear Alabama case resolving the facts that we have here, so there's uncertainty. The proper recourse is to remand. The district court failed to do so here. I want to talk about the ALJ decision. So my friend on the other side talked about how the ALJ made a finding about reasonable predictability and how that bears on guarding by location, TSI's core defense, during the trial. Here's the problem. There's a footnote in the ALJ decision where he says, I do not find that these measurements amount to guarding by location. Okay, fast forward. Now we have TSI's expert saying, well, the ALJ really meant to, he was really performing a guarding by location analysis, but he didn't say it. The parties in a product liability trial, the product liability trial should not hinge on competing interpretations of an ALJ's footnote. That shouldn't happen. That is confusing. And Rule 403 not only outlaws.
But part of the reason for that is that perhaps that's hearsay and you can't ask the ALJ about that in court. And perhaps another reason is that it's opinion testimony. And I don't know that he qualifies as either a lay opinion or a lay witness or an expert witness, but I didn't see either of those objections. It's certainly relevant, right? I don't understand really the relevance objection. It's a similar piece of machinery, et cetera, et cetera. The reason that you are so concerned about it is that it's relevant. And as for prejudice, I'm still not understanding how this fits with other prejudice decisions under Rule 403. Can you explain specifically what your best precedents are for why this information was prejudicial as opposed to not admissible for some other reason?
Yes, Judge Grant. A point to Custer, first and foremost, the Walker decision, the Tyco decision, and the Hines decision. Those four decisions, and specifically Custer, Walker, and Tyco, they establish a through line. And that through line is that Rule 403 serves to protect the exclusive province of the jury. We want the jury to be the ultimate arbiters of the ultimate issues. Here, the ALJ decision deprived them of that ability, of that responsibility. There's given the record in this case and how TSI used it during the trial, there's a serious risk that they just uncritically deferred to the ALJ's findings rather than making findings for themselves independently in the first instance. And that's really the crux of the prejudice. But there's also confusion. Going back to the footnote, competing interpretations of a footnote in an agency document should not come in during a subsequent jury trial. That's going to confuse the jury.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Mulhern. And I think we've got your arguments. We will proceed to